Good morning. The title of our presentation is The Reliability of Spinal Motion Palpation is Enhanced When Raters Are Confident About Their Calls, Preliminary Findings. I want to point out that this is, we had this idea and this was our preliminary foray into looking at it, and it came out, I think, fairly interesting. Co-authors, Robert Cooperstein, who couldn't be here today, Morgan Young, who is a another instructor at our school, Tamara Ghazi, and Erica Jansen, who are here today. There are no personal financial relationships to disclose in this study. Motion palpation is something that is commonly used by chiropractors and other manual therapists around the world, and it's used to assess the intersegmental status of the joint, whether it's hypomobile or hypermobile. And then based on those findings, therapeutic applications are applied. If it is a hypomobility, for instance, perhaps manipulation or mobilization would be applied. And if it's a hypermobility, then exercises to help stabilize that segment would be in order. There have been quite a few previous studies done on motion palpation as far as its reliability. In fact, we recently did a review article and submitted a annotated bibliography, and we had nearly 50 papers included in that bibliography. I think it was 47. So it's been looked at quite a bit, and in the past it's shown that the inter-examiner reliability is slight to poor, and the intra-examiner reliability is slight to moderate. So it's been criticized, and as far as its validity, there essentially is nothing available to show that it's valid. As far as the methods used in previous studies on the reliability of motion palpation, they've typically asked the examiners to evaluate the area, the region of the spine, cervical, thoracic, lumbar, and to choose one segment as being most restricted. And so the examiners would evaluate, say, the thoracic spine, and then they would say, okay, it's T7. And then the next examiner would evaluate, and then they would say it was T3. And then that is a, in the analysis, that would be compared using the kappa statistic, and the agreement is has not been good. Some of the studies have used intra-class correlation coefficient, which is what we used in our study. And I'll tell you how we did that in a little bit. So we call that a forced call, when the examiner is required to say that something is most fixated. And what you have to realize that some people don't have anything to speak of. You know, they have no discernible restrictions in the spine, or they may have multiple areas that are restricted. And so to say one is most restricted can be problematic. In our study, what we did is we allowed the examiners to rate their confidence on each call. So as we palpated, I was one of the palpators, and as we did the palpation, we'd say, okay, T7 is restricted, and then we'd report to another examiner whether we were confident in our findings or not. And then when we did the analysis, we were able to segregate people into whether the examiners, both examiners were confident in their calls, or whether there was a discrepancy as far as one examiner being confident and the other not confident, or both being not confident. So our purpose was to determine the degree of agreement between two independent examiners assessing restrictions in the thoracic spine, taking into consideration their level of confidence for each call. the methods, we chose chiropractic students. They were readily accessible, and they were, for the most part, asymptomatic. So this resulted in a convenient sample. They were excluded if they had significant middle back pain. We said that if they were two or above on the 0 to 11 scale, then they would be eliminated. No subjects were eliminated, though. Like I said, this study involved the thoracic spine, and the procedure involved each of the examiners palpating with their thumbs and springing the joints, as Paul was describing earlier, alongside the spinous processes and into the articular regions of each segment. The patients were prone at the time of the evaluation, and then when the examiners found a segment that was thought to be most restricted, we would place an adhesive marker. And then another examiner would come in, and a measurement would be made from the S1 tubercle up to that marker. Then the marker would be removed, and then the next evaluator would come in and assess the joint, and then measurement would be made again. So what this allowed was for a continuous variable, and then we could do the intra-class correlation coefficient. The examiners, myself and Dr. Cooperstein, and you know, we both used this in practice for many years, and it's something that is used by many chiropractors. And in fact, in a lot of the randomized controlled trials, it's the method of assessing where to give the manipulation. The examiners were blinded to each other's findings, and also not only the region or the area of resistance, but also the confidence that we had. You know, so we didn't know, you know, which of us were confident until the analysis was done. The patients were restricted from giving us any kind of feedback, so they couldn't say, oh, that hurts there, or anything like that. And they were not informed of the results in any time during the study. Also, we randomized the order of the examiners to prevent any kind of order effect from occurring. So as far as our results, we did this on 19 subjects, and most of them were males, 84%. The average age was 26.2 years, height 173.3 centimeters, weight 76.1 kilograms, and pain level on average was 0.6 on a 0 to 10 scale. As far as the confidence, out of those 19, both examiners were confident in their calls on 8 subjects. So 11 subjects, there was no confidence on the part of one of the examiners at least.
Dichotomous.
Pardon?
Dichotomous.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's either yes, confident, or no. Now, out of those 11 people that were not confident, 8 times it was one person was confident and the other was not confident, and 3 times it was both were not confident. But only those where both of us felt confident in our findings, that was 8 subjects. So we analyzed the data, and when we looked at all the subjects, all 19 of them, we found that there was almost no correlation between the examiner's calls. The R value was minus 0.03, and it was not statistically significant. And the index of agreement, the ICC, was 0.03, and the 95% confidence interval was wide from minus 0.467 to 0.420. And this is what the scatter plot looked at that, and it's like a perfect example of no correlation. Now, when we pulled out those eight people where both examiners were confident, we found that they correlated very well. In fact, the R value was 0.84 and the P value was 0.008. And the index of agreement was high, ICC was 0.81, and the 95% confidence interval went from 0.301 to 0.958. And this is what the scatter plot looked like with those people that we were both confident in our calls. And then we looked at the scatter plot and the correlation when there was no confidence. And it was negative, minus 0.5 and not statistically significant. And the index of agreement was minus 0.5. And that's what the scatter plot looked like in that case. So when you think of the problems that we've had in establishing the reliability of motion palpation, this is kind of a statement that may be an indicator of why it's a problem. The practice of forcing a call of fixation on every subject is as fraught with error as running a blood test on a group of subjects and forcing a diagnosis of one disease per blood test. It's just not going to work. And patients that come into are assessed by motion palpation, there are several types of subjects that might be encountered. Some people have only one joint that is, could be considered restricted, and there is a loss or diminished joint play there. Some people have more than one level of involvement, and some people essentially have such little involvement or nothing that you can't, that the examiner wouldn't be able to perceive this. So how could you expect examiners to agree when there is more than one level that are considerable fixations, or if there's no restrictions? It's just going to be by chance that the examiners would agree in any of those cases. And also, in those cases where there's multiple fixations or multiple restrictions and no restrictions, the examiners probably aren't going to be confident in their calls. They're going to, if they're forced to say something, say, well, I don't know, could be T3, could be T7, could be T9, I'll say T3. But they're not going to be confident in that. Experimental situation that we did, that's quite different than clinical practice, though, because in the clinical setting, the examiner or the clinician has options. If a person has multiple areas of restrictions, they can adjust each of those segments if they wish. Or if somebody has no restrictions, the person doesn't need an adjustment. Go on, look for another level, or not adjust in that time. So in conclusion, we think that the examiner's level of agreement was acceptable when they were confident in their calls, and it was poor when they were not confident. And we think that studies in the future that looked at the that forced call studies that look at the reliability of motion palpation may be inherently prone to yield less than robust inter-examiner reliability. And so confidence levels should be considered in future motion palpation reliability studies. Any questions? Yes.
I know that you said that you randomized the doctors to who would go first. But with respect to when the doctors lacked confidence, was there any indication as to whether or not the doctors who lacked confidence maybe went second?
Did not look at that, sorry.
I guess I was saying that, if you're motion palpating a segment, you're still having an effect on the nervous system, and you could increase the motion of the segment.
Could change things.
And it would change that. So I was just curious if the level of confidence decreased more frequently for
We did not look at that. Sorry.
The reason that you marked the segment for measuring up from S1 and typical, just to rule out that you might have miscounted segments, if you said, oh, there's a problem at you guessed T4 and the other person said T5, it was actually the same segment, but one of you had miscounted, is that why you
No, the reason for that is just that practitioners have a difficult time in agreeing on a certain level. Like one doctor will palpate and say, that's T7, when in reality it's T9, and then the other palpates and they're at T7 and they say it's T5. I mean, there's a lot of discrepancy there, so that, you know, we kind of did away with that part of unreliability by doing it that way.
Real quick throwaway question. So if you both agreed that there was a fixation there, was there really a fixation there?
That would be a little validity study, and you know, we didn't look at that. I would think so. Yes.
I found that the negative correlation on the unconfident group, highly interesting, because it would suggest that it's not just a disagreement by chance, you're purposefully disagreeing.
Yeah.
I mean, you're actually come up with opposite results, in fact.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I mean, that's an interesting area to take a look at, because I think it may reflect differences in style in terms of the decisions you make in confident cases. So when you're in a confident area, you're gonna come up with a similar decision process, but if you're looking at things that you're not sure about, you and Coop have different ways of making that decision. And because otherwise, I don't explain the negative correlation.
Right.
That's small sample size.
Hopefully this will open up some new investigations. And do you have a question, Paul?
Yeah, I guess from a very pragmatic standpoint, for those of us who are treating patients, so now we say, okay, well, most of our patients are not reliable. Mike Schneider publishes a paper that says, well, if you poke on them and they get to tell you they hurt, well, mm-hmm. then that seems to be reliable. But in reality, at least in our practice, If a region hurts, we adjust that region, and we look at directional preference. And so this idea of specificity, at least for myself, is kind of diminishing. So do you think that that's the direction we should go, to be less specific, or do you still think that these specific level questions need to be answered?
I do. I think it's a personal opinion, but, you know, like if you adjust the thoracic region, that's pretty long, and if you're hitting T12 when maybe the problem's at T1, it might not influence it.
But
unless you're doing a general.
We have no data that substantiates your stage.
Right. Yeah, that's why I say it's a personal opinion. I mean, just from my experience and practice, I found that my results were better if I was specific on a segment that was restricted. But that's yet to be determined.
Do you think that the results of the study would be different in other groups of mind that just inherently have more motion and therefore potentially have more restriction? The thoracic spine doesn't really have that much motion to begin with.
Well, you know, we do plan on looking at cervical and lumbar. In fact, we're trying to do that this quarter, trying to get that all coordinated. And we'll tell you then.
Just a caveat about this reliability thing. This complements what Dana said, you know, as this is a valid survey there. There's a big contradiction that we have to deal with. Almost all of our adjusted indicators really suck. But it's a technical
term.
I'll leave some more technical terms out. But when you look at the efficacy of manipulation, it's there. So there is a treatment effect, even though we have really no way of figuring out how to treat. So someone has to wonder, what the hell is going on here? That's another technical term. So here's the thing that I suggest. We are measuring the reliability. Can we agree on the same segment? Yes or no? But we don't know yet if that's really how any chiropractor is making the clinical decision on what or where to adjust. So there's a possibility that we are not actually evaluating the reliability of the real clinical process. So once I figured that out, I instantly forgot the first 6 years of my career as a researcher. The other thing is that, does it matter? And so here's the example. My friend Paul Hare adjusts C1, and everyone else in the room, let's say, adjusts L5, but the patient gets better. So do we need to agree? I'll call this the two-story house phenomenon. We're arguing on which light switch turns the light on, the one at the top of the stairs or the one at the bottom, when they both do. So in that case, reliability, even the question of reliability, becomes irrelevant. I mean, it's a statistic that doesn't even mean anything clinically. So just keep that in mind. Reliability stinks, and a lot of these things are probably nonsense. But we don't know for sure yet.
Yeah, and just picking up on that, I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, clinicians are basically, they're all developing individualized clinical heuristics that they use for determining what they're going to do. And we're sitting here trying to quantify these individual heuristics that are based on, what, 70 different ways of looking at Joe Keating's spinal boo-boo, you know? But bottom line, it's basically a clinical heuristic.
I'd argue being in 60,000 different ways in determining. I think we all do it different. And from a pragmatic standpoint, you know, my students want to be so specific, and at the end of the day, we adjust the region that hurts. And so, I, from a very pragmatic standpoint, I'm frustrated by this also. Yeah.
What the non-clinicians, this has another question. Why not just let the patient tell you where it hurts and adjust it and forget all of this? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's what Mike Schneider's paper said. If you poke and it hurts, then that's reliable. But to Dana's point, we don't know if that's valid.
I think with a caveat to rule out the side effects or risks for doing that, I think there's a lot. The key to answer is to qualify, yeah, maybe, given that everything else is handled. So there is certain some clinical decision making that's got to go on.
Well, and the peripheral segments can be hypermobile. You wouldn't want to adjust those segments. So you need to be clinical. It's a choice as to whether or not. You can't always address the area of pain that.
Just a comment. Ultimately, from a big picture point of view, it really doesn't matter. But on a day-to-day basis, I'm working with students who need to learn something. And I'm preparing these guys to go out and perform as chiropractors. And so I need some kind of tools in order to give them. And if none of the tools are any good individually, there's something to it all together. And so, it'd be nice to find out what of those tools seem to have more value than other tools.
Seems like we have a research agenda.
If I could make an argument, and that we want to look at this in our grants, I would argue it's directional preference. That the McKenzie type evaluation is a future way to look, because I'm not so sure it matters what segment, but I do think if Long's study was accurate, and there are questions about that, but if that was accurate, it does matter the direction, at least that you give home exercises in. And so my personal bias is directional preferences, a direction we should head in.
You know, you bring up a good point, and this came up at one of the research agenda conferences a bunch of years ago. I think Bill, this would be at that particular time, and in charge of
not always.
Okay. He was more pissed off than usual, and he put me head of a panel on how to figure out the usefulness of diagnostics. And I went in there and I said, look, we're doing this, and I made this reliability argument, and I said, so this is kind of dumb. So there is a way of getting around that, and it's a block box method. We do a randomized trial. We just test how any way somebody wants to figure out how to do an adjustment, and we randomize them to use that in deciding how to adjust or not use that in deciding how to adjust. And we can find out if there's an effect of the evaluation process. If there is, then you got something. We won't know how it works, but you have something. If it doesn't, then really what you just have to need to do is give the patient, well, you have to told me something anyway. You got to make them confident. And you got to make the patient confident. And maybe we don't need to spend, a whole year learning how to palpate something. We just need to have to. We just need to know how to look good at making our decisions. Of course, that's very hard to do without making them think there's something real there. So there's quite a bit of a dilemma, but there is a way, without making any judgments on reliability, to get past that and figure out if something's going on.
And I would say, too, that this is true for the entire universe of doctors that treat any kind of pain complaint in the body, okay? So Mitch's comments are germane to chiropractors. They're also germane to every other physician out there.
And that's why,
in this area.
And that's why everyone in my panel, took me outside and beat the crap out of me for saying this. So.
Any other comments, questions? States of the art.